大家好，欢迎来到不明白播客，我是主持人袁丽。节目开始前跟大家说个事儿，第二届不明白节将于9月6日在华盛顿举办，线下及线上票都已经开始报名。一个好消息是，我们将给不明白播客的付费订阅用户与捐赠人赠送一张免费的线上票，详情请到播客评论区或我们的社交媒体账号查看并登记报名。本次赠票也适用于9月1日前加入付费订阅的听众，感谢大家一直以来的陪伴，我们希望能得到你们的长期支持，把这个节目长久地办下去。目前线下票还剩余一些名额，欢迎大家来华盛顿一起过节。今天的节目很特别，是英文带中文字幕，嘉宾是著名历史学家、胡佛研究所高级研究员 Stephen Kotkin 考特金教授，他是两卷本《斯大林传》的作者，正在撰写第三卷。他对斯大林的研究重塑了我们对共产集权运作逻辑的理解，他的研究超越了苏联，延伸到全球威权主义，并越来越多地转向当代中国。在这期节目里，我们谈到了他为什么说斯大林而不是毛泽东是独裁者的最高典范，为什么希特勒多次遭遇暗杀而斯大林却没有，如何从斯大林30年代的大清洗来理解习近平目前正在进行的清洗，对于列宁主义集权政权最大的威胁是什么，为什么斯大林、毛泽东和习近平都不愿意指定接班人，以及很多很多有意思的讨论。这次破例用英文录制节目，时长也远超过去的任何一期，因为我相信科特金教授的研究对于理解当下的中国至关重要。在 YouTube 上，我们为听众朋友们准备了精心制作的中文字幕。最后再说一句，我建议听众朋友们对比吴国光教授前两期录制的《习近平失去权力了吗》，以及即将在不明白节上我和蔡霞老师的对话，为何习近平与中共必有一斗但不是恶斗，这是一个混乱令人不安的历史时刻，有太多的不明白，还好我们有这么多优秀的学者来这里传道解惑。 Stephen, welcome to 不明白。
Well, thank you for the honor of the invitation.
You describe Stalin as the gold standard for dictators. Some Chinese, I'm sure, will question why not Mao. Mao people died under Mao's rule, and he built a more pervasive cult of personality, some, you know, many would argue. What makes Stalin's dictatorship more consequential?
Yes, it's a very good question.It depends how you measure. Certainly, if you measure in terms of sheer victims, Mao exceeds anyone. Stalin, including with Lenin, is responsible for maybe 18 to 20 million deaths, directly through executions and indirectly through famine resulting from his policies and disease. Mao is responsible for at least double the number of deaths of Stalin.Again, it depends. The sources are difficult here because no one measured the number of deaths in communist China. Of course, they're only estimates. But certainly the lowest figure one would give for Mao is 40 million, double Stalin, and probably a lot higher. So if you measured solely in terms of the number of victims, not just those who died, but those subjected to his rule, Mao would come on top.You know, often the communists talk about in China how they raised 700 million people out of poverty. Well, of course, the Chinese communist regime put them into poverty in the first place. Per capita GDP during Mao's Cultural Revolution was $200 equivalent at the exchange rate per year. $200 per person per year. So you had more than a billion people living in the poverty.So, and they raised themselves out of poverty, by the way. It wasn't the Chinese regime that did that. So if you look in terms of the deaths and in terms of the impact on even the people who survived, very consequential, Mao's dictatorship. But there are a couple of important caveats or qualifications here. First, Mao came to power because of Stalin. Chinese often complain that Stalin did not support their revolution from the beginning or enough. Insufficient, they charge him with support of communist regime. That Stalin doubted the Chinese Communist Party's chances to win in the Civil War. All of that is true. Stalin did doubt their chances, and Stalin did waver in his support. But in the end, without Stalin, there is no way the Chinese communists could have come to power. There's no way Mao could have come to power without the decisive support, especially military support and weapons, that Stalin did provide the Chinese Communist Party in the end. So in some ways, Mao is derivative of Stalin. So that's one qualification. A second qualification is in terms of the military-industrial complex. China under Mao did not have a military-industrial complex. Sure, it had a large army. Sure, it had some weapon systems. But Stalin built one of the most formidable military-industrial complexes ever. Colossal and strong. In fact, that's how they were part of the victors in World War II over the Nazi land army. And in some ways, China's military-industrial complex, as small as it was again derived from the Soviet Union, from Soviet aid, both finance, but also technology, experts. So in terms of just the sheer power of the state, Stalin's state was much stronger. And then the final qualification I would introduce is that Stalin was a micromanager. Stalin managed policy day to day across all areas, from culture, including novels and films and what was prohibited and what was allowed, editing drafts of Soviet novels before they were published, editing some of the films before they were released, all the way through production, industrial production, personnel, ideology. In so many ways, Stalin managed the whole society, and he did it for a really long time. Mao was not the micromanager that Stalin was. So if you look at how Mao and his regime were in part derivative of Stalin, if you look at the size of the military-industrial complex and the might of the state, and you look at the day-to-day management of the dictatorship, Stalin, in my mind, is still the gold standard, even though Mao had more victims overall.
Some observers argue that Xi Jinping entered office with a clear ambition to return China to a more Maoist authoritarian system. Others see a more gradual process. Xi became significantly more authoritarian by the end of his first term. Is there a comparable trajectory in Stalin's rise? More broadly, what do historical patterns tell us about how modern autocrats consolidate power over time?
Yeah, very difficult question. The Stalin regime is accessible to us because the regime fell, and we have the documentation. Xi Jinping's regime and his personal wishes and intentions are still hidden from us. One of the arguments that I make in my Stalin biography is that it was the system that helped create Stalin, not just the other way around. In other words, we see Stalin as a person not fully formed, not the Stalin that we know from later, when he first takes power. It's the experience of building the personal dictatorship inside the Leninist regime, and then exercising that kind of power after he accumulates it and the consequences of it that makes Stalin the person he is. So that's not to say he lacks a personality. Of course he has a personality. They used to joke under Khrushchev when he gave the cult of the personality speech in 1956. They used to say to him, Nikita, yes, there was a cult of the personality, but there was also a personality, you know, implying that Khrushchev maybe wasn't on that same level. So Stalin had a personality, but I would say he was formed as much by the experience of being a dictator and eventually a despot, of building that power up and of exercising that power and seeing and experiencing the consequences. And so when Xi Jinping comes to power as the top leader of China in 2012, he may have certain proclivities, certain ideas, certain wishes. It's hard to say because he concealed his intentions. His greatest talent, to the extent that he has any talent, I wouldn't exaggerate his talent, but his greatest talent was in concealing his intentions or his ideas from those who helped elevate him and then revealing them only later. But it's likely, again, we don't have the internal documentation and we have to be careful about the limits of our knowledge. But it's likely that the experience of being China's top leader has exerted tremendous influence on him. It's really difficult to manage that system. That system is gigantic. It's colossal in terms of the number of interest groups it has. It's really big, stretching from domestic policy to foreign policy and encompassing the entire globe. That experience would have a big impact on anybody who was thrust into that. Plus, you have the trajectory of the regime that you must take into account. Xi Jinping comes to power 2012 after a long trajectory of the country doing really well economically and building up its power domestically and externally. And so you could speculate of what Xi Jinping might have done had he come to power in 1979. Maybe he would have looked in 1979 more like Deng Xiaoping. Maybe the epoch shaped Deng Xiaoping as much as Deng shaped the epoch. Maybe if Deng Xiaoping had come to power in 2012 instead of 1979, he would look more like Xi Jinping than he would look like the Deng Xiaoping that we know from 1979. I don't want to discount the personality. And it's clear that Xi Jinping has certain beliefs and certain life experiences. And from what we know, including from Joseph Terigian's new biography of Xi Jinping's father, which is a miracle of academic scholarship and impeccable research, it's clear that there are very formative experiences on Xi Jinping as he's growing up and as he's serving in provincial capacities and other capacities on the way to the top leadership position. But it's also clear that the influence of both the position and the time period should also be taken into account when understanding Xi Jinping. So if you think about it this way, the Communist Party wants to preserve its monopoly at all costs. That's the number one goal. They want China to be great. They want China to be powerful. They want China to return to what they regard as its rightful place as the dominant power in East Asia and beyond. But all of that depends, in their mind, on the party retaining its position as the sole decider of all policies inside that big country. And so everything is subordinated to the continuation of the party's rule. Once you allow liberalization in the economy, as Deng Xiaoping did, in order to revive the economic prospects of the country, in order to get out of the poverty that Mao's policies and the communist regime had placed the country in, once you do that, you then risk the party's monopoly on power. And so you have to figure out how to balance the new private sector activity, the new independent sources of wealth and power that come from the private sector, with the party's political monopoly. Deng Xiaoping, as you know, never relaxed the party's political monopoly. There was no liberalization in the political sphere to the degree that there was in the economic sphere. And then Deng's successor, Jiang Zemin, has to confront this contradiction of relying on the private sector to revive the country, but worried about the private sector's threat to Communist Party monopoly. And Jiang Zemin comes up with the three represents. You know this well. And so his idea is to allow the Communist Party membership for the capitalists, to let the capitalists into the party. If the capitalists, the private sector people, come into the party, maybe that will influence their behavior and help fortify the communist monopoly. So bringing the private sector into the party, of course, this doesn't work. They do allow the private sector people to come into the party, but it doesn't reduce the threat to Communist Party monopoly. It doesn't reduce the corruption. It doesn't reduce the power of the private sector. So Xi Jinping comes along after this, and he's not going to do the three represents, bring the capitalists into the Communist Party. He's going to do the opposite. He's going to force the Communist Party back into the private sector at all levels, meaning Communist Party bosses are going to be the CEOs of the companies. They're going to run the boards. And so the private sector will no longer be a threat to the Communist Party's political monopoly because the party will go into the private sector rather than the private sector coming into the party. So I think just about any communist leader in China would have tried something similar as Xi Jinping has tried after the failure of Jiang Zemin's three represents. And so, again, we understand that Xi Jinping has a personality. He has preferences. His relationship to Mao, his relationship to the Maoist era, all of that is very important. But there's a dynamic and a trajectory at play here of protecting Communist Party rule at all costs while needing to rely on the private sector for economic growth and job creation. And that gives you a certain kind of policy, first the one tried by Jiang and now the one tried by Xi Jinping. And you can see that it's logical that someone in his position coming to power in 2012 would address this problem and would address it in this particular way. So I don't want to diminish his personality, but I do want to talk about the larger structural dynamics.
So as long as the Communist Party is in power, there would not be political reform. Because when Xi Jinping came to power, so many Chinese intellectuals and officials were like, oh, he's going to be a reformer. His father was a reformer. He's going to reform the party, you know, politically.
So his father was a reformer under Deng Xiaoping in a different epoch, let's remember. I don't know what his father would have been like today. Maybe more like the son. So, of course, the wishful thinking about what Xi Jinping would do. Tremendous wishful thinking about reform. And let's remember, it was all throughout the communist structures, this wishful thinking. It wasn't just foreign observers. Many people in the Central Party School were predicting that Xi Jinping would be a reformer. They wrote reform blueprints for him. For Xi Jinping in the period 2008, 2009, 2012. And of course, their naivete looks silly in retrospect. But there was a sense in which the regime had been successful with economic opening, so why not political opening, even if it came later than the economic opening? The problem with these arguments or this wishful thinking was that you cannot be half communist. Just like you cannot be half pregnant. You either have the political monopoly of the Communist Party or the regime begins to unravel. We know every case of attempted political liberalization, not economic, but political liberalization under a communist rule, ended up liquidating the system unintentionally. How did that happen? Well, you announce that there's going to be liberalization of the party's rule, that there will be debate inside the party's monopoly. And what happens is people say, oh, debate is free now. We can talk freely. Some of them decide they don't want the Communist Party. They want other political parties. They want more like a Western system or the kind that you have in India, which is to say a constitutional order and a democracy, the kind you have in Taiwan, for example. And the Communist Party objects and says, no, that's not what we mean by political liberalization. We mean debate inside the Communist Party monopoly. So we retain the party's rule, but we just allow liberalization of the party's rule. Again, you cannot have half pregnant, half communism. What happens is the liberalization begins to be anti-communist and to unravel the communist monopoly as people demand other political parties, and they demand that the freedoms granted for inside the party be used outside the party as well. And each time we see this, Hungary in 1956, Czechoslovakia in 1968, and Gorbachev in the 1980s, each time we see this attempted liberalization in the political sphere, the Communist Party's monopoly unravels, and there's no political reform equilibrium. There's no place where you begin to liberalize politically, and then you can stop and stabilize. Instead, once you open political liberalization, you begin to see this unraveling dynamic like a political bank run. And so then you either get a crackdown, which is what happened in Hungary in 56 when the Soviets sent the tanks, or Czechoslovakia in 68 again when the Soviets sent the tanks. In the Gorbachev case, the crackdown came very late and it failed, and the communist regime unraveled. Once you've seen what's happened in the Soviet Union, and you are a leader of the Chinese Communist Party, you will not permit political reform, political liberalization of Communist Party rule. Because you know from the Soviet case, it is self-destruction, auto-liquidation. And so all of them, when they go to the party school, and this has been true for a long time now, they learn two things. One, the idea, actually the myth, that the East is rising and the West is declining. They hear this again and again and again. The decadence of the West, the decline of the West, the desperation of the West. And the other thing that they hear is Gorbachev and how there will be no Gorbachev in China. There will be no attempted open political liberalization, opening of the political system. China will not destroy Communist Party rule. Now, had Gorbachev not happened, China might have had a Gorbachev. It might have had some political leader who had illusions that you could liberalize the communist system and keep it in power, that there was a mysterious reform equilibrium where you began to open the system and it stabilized and it worked. But now that they've seen the Gorbachev, they will never do this. So when Xi Jinping comes to power in 2012 and people are predicting he's going to be a political reformer, they don't understand the history of communism, of Leninist regimes, the structure of Leninist regimes, and therefore they don't understand that Xi Jinping is limited in the choices he can make. He's not going to open the system politically because that means he would be the man to destroy the system like Gorbachev. That opportunity, that pathway is closed to China. They can open economically as long as they retain tight political control over the economic sphere, the way Xi Jinping is reintroducing, as we said, the party into the private sector. But opening up politically was not an option for him because of what happened under Gorbachev, and they study this again and again. The cadre all study this at the party school. And of course, Xi Jinping took over the party school when he headed the secretariat in the years before he became the primary leader. And so he was the one that helped introduce this transformation from the party school advocating political opening to the party school studying how political opening is communist suicide, and we will never do this in China.
It's the machine of the party, not the Xi. Just just Xi alone, right?
You're right. It's the structure of a Leninist regime. Now, you can argue that not everybody believes in Marxism in China. Whether Xi Jinping believes in Marxism or not is hard for us to judge, and we can have different opinions. Many people who are members of the Communist Party might not believe in Marxism. And so when you call it a Marxist-Leninist regime, you invite debate about how Marxist is it really. So I don't call it a Marxist-Leninist regime. I call it a Leninist regime because it has a Leninist structure, this inability to do political reform and survive. That's the nature of a Leninist regime. So China has a Leninist regime, whether it's Marxist or not Marxist, again, to be debated, but you cannot debate whether it has a Leninist regime or not. And Xi Jinping didn't create that Leninist regime. He's a product of it, and he's now a great defender of that regime. And his lifelong mission is to ensure the survival of that regime. And ensuring the survival is to forbid political reform in any meaningful sense. So it's about the structure of a Leninist regime, not only his personal wishes or personality.
Right, yeah. Stalin executed hundreds of military commanders in the 1941 Red Army purge, and Xi Jinping is not executing his officers, but he has systematically removed top generals and military leaders. Do you see any meaningful parallels between these two campaigns? And what do they reveal about how authoritarian leaders maintain control over the armed forces?
Yeah, those are really difficult questions and important questions. It's the force ministries that are critical to the survival of the regime, ultimately. Because if the people become disillusioned, if they oppose the regime through acts of courage or other ways, the force that's left is the army and the security police. And so the army and the security police loyalty is critical to the survival of the regime. That's true of all authoritarian regimes, not just communist regimes. What's very interesting about Stalin is he murdered his military officers and his KGB generals, his KGB officers, while they were murdering others. So they were arresting people and putting them up on false charges, torturing them, forcing them to confess, to imagine crimes. But some of those very torturers, some of those very people who are oppressing the others and sending them to execution, themselves were arrested and executed, not afterwards, but during. This is one of the most amazing things of communism, that it kills its own loyalists. It destroys its own loyalists. People who don't waver in their loyalty are nonetheless targeted by the regime in its paranoia and its paroxysms. So, you know, Xi Jinping and the military is a deep, fundamental question. We have many experts on this question. Let me approach it this way. Suppose you are an official in the communist system, and suppose you have a provincial appointment. They send you to the province, and you become the number two or the number one in the province. While serving there, you develop a bunch of relationships with people who are dependent on you, your subordinates. And then you get assigned to another province, and the same thing happens. And you build up a team of loyalists who owe their lives and positions to you. By the time you get to Beijing, if you've served in two or three provinces, you have 10 or 15 loyalists from one province, 10 or 15 loyalists from another. So you get to Beijing, you have under 50 people who are your people. They are beholden to you, and they wouldn't have their positions without you, and they've worked under you for a long time, and so you know their loyalty. Then you get to Beijing, and Beijing is this monster of interest groups and bureaucracy and the military and the secret police, and You cannot rule this system with 50 loyalists that you've brought from the provinces. There is just no way to manage the scale of this with only 50 loyalists or even 100 loyalists that you've brought from the provinces. So you begin to discover how difficult, how challenging it is to oversee the security police, to oversee the military, to oversee this economic bureaucracy, to oversee the ideology, to oversee the foreign policy, the ambassadors, the spy networks. It's just enormous how big the system is and how many people are in it. So how are you going to manage? How is an individual going to accumulate the kind of power, not on paper, where he's proclaimed the paramount leader at the party congress or in other ritualistic settings? How do you have effective power, real power, so that when you're not in the room, when you're not present, when you're not at the meeting, you can rely on them to implement your will and not sabotage, betray you, make alliances with others, falsely report what you're doing in order to gain a medal when you're doing the opposite? How can you do that as the paramount leader when the system is so big and you don't have enough loyalists? And so you begin to try to find new loyalists. You begin to try to appoint people to positions of authority, especially in the military and the secret police, who are trusted by you and who owe their appointment to you and won't betray you or won't collude with others behind your back. And then you appoint them and you discover that, you know what? They're not all loyal only to me. Some of them are having conversations with others. Some of them are stealing money and not telling me about it. Some of them are promoting their own subordinates to positions of power without me knowing about it. Sometimes their own children. And so you begin to see that the people you thought were your own loyalists have their own interests, have their own networks, have their own patronage, have their own families, have their own wealth. And so what are you supposed to do? Who can you trust? Who's really your person? Remember, it's the secret police and the military that could potentially remove you. Those are the groups that you have the most to worry about. You're very reliant on them for your own personal security. We think of Xi Jinping as all powerful, but remember, somebody has to cook his food. Somebody has to taste his food. Somebody drives his cars, flies his airplanes, cleans his rooms where he's present, helps him with his communications network. There's a gigantic apparatus that services the supreme leader at any given time. And all of those people are points of vulnerability. What about his food? Someone can come into the apartments where he's living or the offices where he works and look like they're cleaning, but instead smearing poison across the desk or across the chair or across the computer screen. Someone can put something in his food. Someone can spray something with an aerosol in the air. Someone can collude to drive the car into an accident. Someone can plant a bomb. And you can use your imagination for all the possibilities. So you're living in a system where many, many people have access to you as a person. Many, many ministries or bodies, agencies have huge amount of power because of guns and access to cyber and other tools. And so you're trying to command all of this. You're trying to preside over it so that it remains loyal to you. And you, again, you discover that some of these people have their own businesses on the side, have their own patronage networks and loyalties. So you can maybe create animosities and factions. You can maybe say, okay, this one in the military, how about if I put another person in the military and they fight with each other? And so each of them will snitch They will tattle on each other to me. And I'll find out what they're up to because they're rivals, they're enemies. They hate each other. And so you begin to try to exacerbate the rivalries, the competition, the animosities within the system, the different interest groups. So some you reward and others you punish, and then those you rewarded you punish a little bit, and you reward the ones you were punishing. This is a really difficult, time-consuming, 24/7 task that you as the supreme leader cannot do. Your time is just limited on a day-to-day basis. You can't stretch across the whole system. So again, you're going to be reliant on people. And 3 people, 5 people, 7 people cannot do this. 50 people can't do this. 100 people can't do this. This is many thousands and thousands and thousands of people in positions of power who could either be loyal or could pose a threat. Now, it's not easy for them to collude with each other, but it's something that you're concerned about and have to watch. So in the military, he appoints certain people. He discovers that they're his appointees, they're his loyalists, but they're doing some other things. And so he removes them. As you've seen now, we've had 3 people from the Central Military Commission, the highest body in the military, be removed. And they were ostensibly Xi Jinping's people. So this tells you about the difficulties of managing a system this big. And so your power depends not solely on what's written on paper, but your credibility and authority with the cadre. So this is why Deng Xiaoping had much more power than Xi Jinping has. Because Deng Xiaoping commanded loyalty even when he was not in the room, and not only out of fear, but out of belief, and out of respect, and out of admiration. And even if Deng didn't have every single formal position, he still had more power. People looked up to him as a man of the original revolution, as a man who rescued China from Mao's Cultural Revolution, as a man dedicated and committed to the survival of the party, not just his own rule. And so Xi Jinping aspires to that kind of power. But we're seeing his difficulties in managing the scale of the system. And although on paper he has that kind of power, in practice I'm doubtful that he has the kind of power that Deng Xiaoping exercised. We will see. Of course, we will see. It's very difficult to predict. It's very opaque. There are tremendous limits to what we know and can know. The system is not easy to interpret, even from the inside, let alone from the outside. The insiders themselves have trouble understanding how the system is working, who's loyal and who's not, and what to do. So for outsiders, it's doubly difficult. My point is not that Xi Jinping is in trouble, that he is going to be overthrown, that his rule is under tremendous threat. I have no idea about any of that, and I don't think very many people do. That's speculation, and I don't engage in speculation. My point is about the difficulties of managing such a big system for anybody, no matter how talented, no matter how shrewd, and the system is bigger now than it was under Deng, and Xi Jinping is challenged to manage that system, to get policies implemented. When they announce policies and they don't get implemented, they announce them again, and they announce them again. And that's because you cannot control this system no matter how much power you have on paper. And so that's a dynamic that we should pay attention to, less the idea of a coup and more the limits of Xi Jinping's power on day-to-day or policy issues throughout the system.
You know, you touch upon this question a little bit. You know, I listened to a podcast you did with somebody else, and you talked about the assassination of there was no a documented attempt to assassinate Stalin, but there were several attempts to assassinate Rudolf Hitler. And, you know, we talk about, like, why was Stalin never targeted, and what lessons might that offer in understanding the stability of communist dictatorship? You talk about Xi's power is limited, but we did not see any serious challenge to his power.
So how do we explain the lack of assassination attempts on Stalin versus Hitler and what the implications might be for Xi Jinping's rule? First of all, Stalin murdered a lot of people in the elite. And so this introduces fear. It's clear that your life is on the line here, that you're under surveillance, and that they know what you're up to, and your driver is reporting on you, and your maid is reporting on you, and your cooks are reporting on you, and sometimes even your spouse and your children are reporting on you behind your back. And so there are a lot of inhibitions because of the fear, the surveillance and the fear to come after Stalin. But that wouldn't be enough. What's critical is the adherence to Stalin, the loyalty to Stalin, out of genuine conviction. Most of the people who get exposed to Stalin from the inside are impressed with how good he is at managing the dictatorship, how much responsibility he's able to bear, how much he knows about the various different portfolios, including their own portfolio that Stalin is indirectly overseeing. The more they learn about Stalin's capabilities in general, there are some exceptions, the more they're impressed of his dedication to the cause and his abilities. And so, whereas Hitler's generals and some of his other officials became convinced that Hitler was a nemesis, that Hitler was hurting Germany, that Hitler's policies were self-defeating, and that they tried to save Germany from Hitler, the people around Stalin thought that Stalin was protecting the Soviet Union, that he was upholding the cause of communism and the great power status of the Soviet Union. That was true also of many people in the society. Even those who disliked the communist system generally thought that Stalin didn't know about the negative things that were happening. They had this myth that if only Stalin knew, he would fix it. And so not all but much of the society, not all but a very, very significant part of the elite, by conviction, were loyal to Stalin. So this, in addition to the fear and surveillance, this loyalty out of a sense of conviction helped protect Stalin. Then you have to add in the fact that he was extremely paranoid in his self-protection and didn't expose himself by walking out into crowds or by allowing random people to have access to his offices. Stalin's part of the Kremlin required a special pass even for elite members of the regime. The whole Kremlin required a special pass. But even if you had a special pass into the Kremlin, you needed another special pass to get to Stalin's wing of the Kremlin. So he was very well protected by his own measures and paranoia, but also by his dedication to the cause and his perceived effectiveness in defending the cause. You know, so again, with Xi Jinping, the elite is loyal out of fear, and of course the surveillance that they're under, but they're also loyal if they believe that Xi Jinping's policies are helping China in the long run. To the extent that they begin to doubt Xi Jinping's policies, that they begin to doubt his competence, that they begin to worry that Xi Jinping's rule is hurting China, hurting the Communist Party, rather than protecting China, protecting the party, advancing China's power, To the extent that they begin to have doubts about Xi as a manager of China's power, then he becomes more vulnerable. Again, we're not predicting that a coup could happen. We're not predicting that his power is in trouble. I have no such information, and I think we have to be careful about speculation. I'm just saying that one of the great vulnerabilities of the regime is when the elite begins to have doubts. Those doubts can be personal because they are losers in the power struggle. They want to acquire a certain property or position and someone else gets it, and then they become resentful of having lost the power struggle, and the resentment builds. The more people you purge, the more people who don't get the favors, the rewards, the private sector properties, the more resentful or angry people you have in the elite, which is dangerous for Xi Jinping and for the system. And also the more ambitious they are. If they feel that they could do a better job, but they're not promoted fast enough, if they feel that incompetent people are promoted instead of them, when they could have done a better job, they become resentful. But even the patriotism is a critical variable here, because many of them, for patriotic reasons, could determine that Xi Jinping is hurting China, even while he intends to make China more powerful, and they can see a divergence between Xi Jinping's personal rule and the survival of communist rule and the great power, the might of China. So if they should become resentful of losing out in power struggles, if they should become resentful from not getting the promotion that they felt they deserved or the rewards of property and assets, but even more fundamentally, if their patriotism should move them to conclude that Xi Jinping's rule is failing China rather than protecting China, you could see a vulnerability to Xi's rule. And it's that fragmentation of the elite's loyalties. It's that separation of the elite from the personal rule of Xi Jinping that we have to watch most closely. And that's where a great opportunity could arise. You can play on that dissatisfaction. You can play on that resentment. You can encourage it. You can make sure that the society in China, and especially the elites themselves, know how many disillusioned Communist Party bosses and military officers and secret police officers there are, whether out of resentment, ambition, or patriotism. So that's the way I would understand our opportunity. This regime has a huge amount of resentment, failed people's careers, purged or not promoted, demoted people, and those disaffected people in the elite may not vocalize their disaffection and resentment because the costs are too high. They could suffer imprisonment and execution. But those resentments, that disaffection is present.
You remind me of the CIA advertisement recruiting Chinese officials. I don't know if you saw those. It was like a few months ago. They played to that disillusionment, resentment. And I saw two ads. They were not very good commercials, but it was like really interesting. They kind of identified there were disillusionment among the Chinese Communist Party officials. And they said, if you are like these people, these characters in the commercial, come to work with us. I guess that's like what you just mentioned.
Yes, and I don't know how effective that is. I have no such information. I don't have a security clearance, and I don't get that kind of insider information. But I will say that whether it's effective or not in recruiting people, it's effective in spreading the message that the disaffection and the resentment exist. You remember from the COVID episode, first the zero COVID, And then they let it rip, COVID, where they removed all the restrictions of zero COVID. People protested the zero COVID. And they protested at risk to them, to their lives and to their families. And it was very impressive how courageous they were in the protests. What was interesting was that the regime unintentionally allowed people to understand something that otherwise was a secret. People who were disillusioned or angry themselves, they knew it. They knew their own feeling. But they couldn't know about everybody else. And if they were to ask about those other people, it could get them in big trouble. If they were to go around asking, are you angry about Communist Party rule just like me? They could get in big trouble. So what the regime did is it enabled individuals to see that they weren't alone in their anger and frustration. The regime organized with zero COVID a kind of unwitting, an unintentional, unwitting referendum on its own rule. And people discovered that they were not alone and that many, many, many of their neighbors were also angry and resentful at the misrule, the incompetence, and the lack of consultation of Communist Party rule. And so this was a big revelation, and you cannot go back. The regime cannot go back and undo revealing to the society that the people who are angry at the regime are not alone, that many share their views. And so that was a really important and interesting episode, unintentional by the regime, but very consequential by the regime. It's harder to do that with the elite. The ordinary people who did that, protesting courageously on their own and then discovering that they were not alone. With the elite, we assume that there are many disillusioned. We know some of them because there are leaks. There are some defections. There are the occasional appearances on the internet briefly as you follow closely of elite dissatisfaction. It disappears quickly, but it appears. So we have small evidence that there is such dissatisfaction. And I think the regime is quite afraid of this sentiment. And so when the CIA puts out these recruitment advertisements, it is effectively spreading that disillusionment, disaffection, fury, anger idea that that sentiment exists. And it's not just you individually, but it's the colleagues you work with who secretly believe the same thing but don't want to say it. And I think that's an effective way to counter the regime and knock it off balance, put it on the back foot rather than the front foot, to try to disseminate the notion that there is resentment and anger inside the communist elites, including in the military and the police.
That's very interesting. Yeah, I never thought from that that angle. But yes, the white paper movement, what you mentioned about the public protests at the end of the zero COVID policy, it is, you know, I interviewed many people, many protesters, and people who did not take up to the street at the time, but they came to talk to me how that those protests revealed to them exactly what you mentioned. It revealed to them that there are many people who were as angry as they were at the zero COVID policy. And many people decided to vote with their feet. They left China, or they listened to my podcast and they try to understand what they don't know, what's going on in China. That exactly what you mentioned. Yeah.
We have to remember not to be anti-China. China is a great civilization, one of the greatest civilizations in recorded history. Its achievements are awesome. It's just profound how amazing China is in culture, in the arts, in the entrepreneurialism of the people, the diligence, the hard work of the people, in the scientific inventions. It's thrilling to watch and to experience Chinese culture. The problem for me is the communists try to assume that they are the main protectors of Chinese culture and civilization. And to the extent that we appear anti-China, we help the Chinese Communist Party conflate communist monopoly rule and protection of Chinese civilization. We need to deconflate. We need to separate this out. Let me give you an example of deconflation of communist rule and the greatness of Chinese civilization. Here at Stanford, I'm right now in my office in the Hoover Tower at Stanford University, Hoover Institution. Before I came here full-time 3 years ago, there was a Confucius Institute on the Stanford campus. And the Confucius Institute was abolished by Stanford. Now, they discovered that the Confucius Institute was engaged in activities that violated Stanford policies. There were many things that became public and some other things that I don't know about, potentially, that the Institute was doing. But the Institute was behaving as a Communist Party organization on the Stanford campus, not as a free and open scientific research and teaching unit on the campus like the other units on the campus. And so the decision was made to end these activities violating Stanford policy and to abolish the Confucius Institute. That was a mistake in my view. I would not have done that.
Why?
What I would have done would have been to establish a new Stanford-only Confucius Institute right across the street from the Communist Party one, to compete with the Communist Party one. Because I want to show that I'm in favor of Confucius. I'm in favor of Chinese culture. I'm in favor of Chinese civilization. And there's a way to propagate Chinese culture and civilization in a free and open fashion, in a way that comports with American values and American institutions, but also the aspirations of many, many Chinese people, both inside mainland China and outside. And so I would have not made the mistake of the appearing to be anti-Confucius, anti-China, by closing down the Confucius Institute and then allowing the Chinese party to complain and the party to say, well, only the party protects Chinese culture. Only the party protects Confucius. You see, we made the mistake of allowing the party to conflate the greatness of China with the party's rule, as opposed to deconflate and say, the Communist Party does not own Confucius. The Communist Party does not own Chinese civilization. Now, you see right now in the diaspora, including in Japan, where I go regularly, that there's a very substantial community of Chinese in self-exile who are strong patriots and lovers of Chinese culture and civilization. But they're looking for an environment to be able to practice that culture, to be able to admire and advance that civilization under conditions of freedom. And so you see that efflorescence of Chinese culture outside of mainland China, outside of CCP control. And that's what we need to do here at Stanford as well. I want to see deconflation of communist rule and the greatness of Chinese civilization. China was a great civilization for thousands of years before the Communist Party. And no foreigner has killed more Chinese than the Chinese Communist Party has killed. And no foreigner has hurt Chinese culture and Chinese society more than the Communist Party. And so the idea that the Communist Party is the protector of Chinese civilization, culture, and the Chinese people is empirically false. So we have to be careful not to give them ammunition to propagate this falsehood, this mythology about their defense of this great civilization.
I have to say, unfortunately, this administration has given a lot of things to the Communist Party, from shutting down Voice of America, you know, and limiting the student visas and many other things. And there are people on both sides in the U.S., especially on the left, and people in China, the nationalists, are talking about the United States is more becoming like China. It's becoming kind of autocratic, and it doesn't really hold up the beacon. It's no longer a beacon of freedom. How would you respond to criticism like this? Especially to people in China who are arguing that the U.S. is no longer a free country and it's behaving in some ways just like the Communist Party.
I understand the critique that some of the current U.S. policies are self-defeating, that they contravene U.S. values, and that they help Chinese propaganda. That critique has a basis. I think it goes too far, but nonetheless, there's some truth to it. I'm able to say that freely, and nothing will happen to me. The U.S. society is where the strength of America comes from. The U.S. society is where soft power comes from. It's where the economic growth and dynamism come from. We have to be careful. Just as I'm arguing not to conflate Communist Party rule and Chinese civilization, not to conflate United States values with any particular administration that might be in power for a short period of time in Washington. The U.S. has a federal system, so it's not just Washington where policies get enacted. We have states. We have municipalities, we have local governance, the beauty of the federal system, and there's quite a lot of variance across the states and how they behave. What happens in Washington, generally speaking, it doesn't always endure. Presidents come and go, policies may change, institutions are more lasting and enduring, and those institutions have lasted almost 250 years now, through a lot of upheaval and a lot of presidencies and a lot of crazy policies. Let's just talk about the American economy for a second. The U.S. was 25% of global GDP since 1880. That's almost 150 years. It's 25% of global GDP today, just like it was in 1880. Some years it was a little bit more, some years it was a little bit less, but by and large, 5% of the global population today, the United States, accounts for 25% of global GDP. This has been true when there were tariffs and when there were no tariffs. This has been true when there was income tax, and then when there was no income tax. It was true when there was high immigration, and it was true when there was immigration restrictions. So through all sorts of different policy regimes, the U.S. dynamism in the society and the economy has been strong since 25% of the global GDP since 1880. So we have to be careful not to put too much weight on any given policy that happens and on any given presidency or Congress or governorship or time period. Again, I understand the critique of current policies. The U.S. immigration was very open and now it's being more restricted. Chinese talent was very welcome and now it's being less welcome. These things have happened in the past in the United States. The United States is the most successful immigration country in recorded history, and it's also a country that has these periods of anti-immigration, very powerful anti-immigration, and the Chinese have been at the center of this in the past, as you know, including after they built the railroad out here in the Pacific to get to places like California, where I'm now employed. So this is American history, and we have to know it in all its dimensions, positive, negative, and in between. We need to have foreign talent come to America. The secret success of America is that people from all over the world want to come here voluntarily and risk everything, give up their lives and come here with nothing in order to make something of themselves. They do that at the lowest end, manual labor, and the highest end of the most sophisticated scientists. This is an awesome story, and it is a great source of America's success, current power, and it will be true in the future. It will happen again in the future that America is more open to foreign talent than it seems like it is right now. Having said that, people still want to come here despite everything that's happening in current immigration policy. Again, current immigration policy makes sense to me in some ways because it was too open, and now there's a correction underway. And that correction can look harsh, but it can look like an overcorrection. But there was a definite problem, and that problem required some kind of solution, even if many people are not happy with the exact nature of the current solution. But it will never be the case that America remains closed for an extended, enduring period of time, even though we're undergoing this correction now. You know, one of the things to understand is that America imports mathematics. In the United States, we have 340 million people. We only have 1.5 million teachers of mathematics. It's not enough. Our mathematics teaching is weak. And so in order to be a scientific innovation superpower, we need to import mathematics. We import mathematics from South Asia, from India. We import it from East Asia, from South Korea and Japan and Taiwan and mainland China. We import mathematics from West Africa. Importing mathematics will continue because the U.S. cannot live without this import of mathematics. We also need 1 million new teachers of mathematics domestically. We need to teach our own American-born children mathematics much better. But even if we got another million teachers of math on top of the 1.5 million we have, we desperately need that. But even if we got that, we would still be compelled to import mathematics from those places that teach mathematics in school at a high level and where those students and young adults want to come to the United States and use their talents to try to achieve something. So we won't end that because we cannot end that. We're dependent on that. So it is a period of confusion, this correction, this necessary correction. But we have to take this longer term and more historical view to understand it. America is not becoming like China. America's institutions are not a Leninist regime. And America has multiple sources of power and a self-organized, free and open society and a tremendous, impartial and professional judiciary and a gigantic class of lawyers. And I could go on, and as well as the federal system. And if you don't like what's happening in America, you can work to change it. You can work to change it openly. And you can work to change it through the institutions, through the society, through the NGOs, the non-governmental organizations. There are a lot of ways to make America better that ordinary citizens can exercise and are exercising as we speak on this podcast.
Yeah. As opposed to China, that there's only hope of a leadership change. You know, if Xi Jinping remains in office, it's very hard to imagine any dramatic change of policies. So let's move on to trade and technology. Many American analysts today are struck by China's rapid advances in AI, EV, clean energy, and battery technologies. Some believe that China is at technological parity with the U.S. or even outpacing it in key areas. A few even argue that the 21st century will be China's century. So for this topic, we have an expert question from Xu Chenggang, political economist at Stanford and a visiting fellow at the Hoover Institution. His question is, in terms of the technological race with the West, what was the significance of the Soviet nuclear bomb and the Sputnik era? What lessons can be drawn from the Cold War about winning a technological race? How do Soviet achievements compare with those of China today?
Very good question. Thank you from a very good colleague here at Stanford. China is a technological superpower. And they've done that partially by studying, learning from America, partially by stealing technology from America, and partially by improving on that American technology or Western technology that they've made better in many cases. China's just enormously impressive, including in the scientific and technological sphere. The universities, the laboratories, the personnel, some of whom studied in the United States and some of whom have never studied in the United States. I'm okay with that. I'm okay with technological competition with China. It should make us better. If the United States is as good as we believe ourselves to be, if the United States is good at technology and scientific innovation, well, let's compete. Let's compete and let's show that we're good at this. The Soviet Union was also a scientific technological superpower. People forget, because the Soviet Union was not a consumer-driven economy, and because the Soviet Union collapsed, people forget how good they were in science and math, in innovation, in military-industrial applications. It was a different time and a different style of technology. Back in the day, the military-industrial complex was a place. It was a series of laboratories, university laboratories and national laboratories. It was a series of big production facilities. It was a place where there was security, there was protection, it was hard to get into. Sometimes spies were recruited there. But for the most part, you could protect your scientific innovation. The Soviets had that as well. They had an enormous military-industrial complex. They had tremendous scientific innovation. They were really good at competing with the U.S. in the scientific military sphere. Today we live in the dual-use epoch, where everything is both civilian and military. So instead of the military-industrial complex being some gigantic laboratory or some gigantic factory in the California desert, the military-industrial complex is right here in my hand. This is it. It's my phone. It's software. And so it's much harder to keep people out. It's much harder to protect your secrets and your innovations. When everything is interconnected, when the military-industrial complex is your everyday portable computer known as your phone in your hand, it's a different kind of competition. But that's okay. It's different. It's not the same as the Soviet Union. China is a consumer military-industrial complex out of the dual-use technologies. So those technologies that help consumers order their rides, buy their food, make their reservations on an airplane, that's the same software, that's the same technology that helps make missiles fly in the air and be precise in where they're going to target, where they're going to land. The Soviet Union had a industrial in the heavy industry, old style industry, military industrial complex, scientific applications, not in the consumer goods way. China benefits from consumer goods having military applications. And so if you can develop across the board in industries, you can become a military scientific superpower because of this dual use nature of the way things work today. Civilian and military use being in the same system, the same kind of software. The Soviet Union was very successful at reaching military parity with the United States in the 1970s. Similar numbers of nuclear weapons, about 40,000 at peak, just like the United States, more or less. Chemical weapons, a secret biological weapon program that people didn't know about. Fighter aircraft, in addition to the nuclear stuff on the conventional side. Massive numbers of tanks. And all sorts of heavy industrial weaponry. In space, the Soviets were good. You mentioned the Sputnik in 1957, the first artificial satellite where they beat the U.S. into space. We could also talk about the space station, the Soviets' space station, and many other their satellites, communication satellites. China has all of this as well, and very impressively, and is developing even more. So we competed against the Soviet Union, and our competition was not only military-industrial, not only scientific and innovation, it was also legitimacy, political legitimacy, and free and open society. And that's the area where the Soviets could not compete. They couldn't compete in consumer goods, which hurt them, and they spent the money on the industrial military production at the expense of consumer goods, rather than the two going hand in hand as they do today. But they ultimately lost because they lacked the political legitimacy. Their people were not asked to consent to their rule and were not given a choice in the formation of policy. And so that free and open society, that political legitimacy, that enduring institutional flexibility and resilience, that's what the Chinese Leninist regime lacks. So they can compete in technology for sure. As we were saying, very impressive. And we must raise our game here in the United States to compete with them. We need the kind of investments across the board in fundamental science and in science that doesn't necessarily have immediate applications, like we had in the Cold War competition with the Soviet Union. Very difficult. Who's going to pay for it? Especially under budgetary constraints, but very necessary because it's part of the secret of our prosperity, not just our ability to deter or, God forbid, to fight a clash with China or another power. So all of this fundamental science competition with China, as long as it doesn't devolve into war, I have no issues with that because I know we can compete. And we should compete. And I know that we have the strength of our political institutions, our political legitimacy over the long term in an enduring fashion that gives us a leg up, not just technology, but the political institutions. That's the fearsome combination for which the Soviets had no answer and the Communist Party has no answer. You know, when the Soviets were stuck and couldn't do structural reform, they turned to technology as their salvation. The Brezhnev years, and to an extent the Gorbachev years, before Gorbachev embarked on the deep structural reform that accidentally destroyed communist rule, the political liberalization, they were trying to have technology solve their problems. Don't do structural reform because that upsets the system, and have technology solve all your problems. Well, it didn't work, and it doesn't work, and it can't fix the political legitimacy deficit or the fragility of Leninist rule. And so while I'm impressed with China's scientific and innovation capabilities, and while I think the U.S. needs to compete and compete better, I feel that we're also competing in the political space, and we need to compete even better in the political space, not just in the scientific and technological space.
So you don't really care about, like, the U.S. government allowed NVIDIA to sell AI chips to China again, and the U.S., like, whether TikTok should be banned, and you don't think those are not the core issues?
Those are important policy questions, and there are debates, legitimate debates on each side, whether to allow the sale of the chips. I don't think you should ever make unilateral concessions, ever, in a negotiation with your rivals, with other great powers. And so I would not have done what the current administration did with the H20 chips if I were going to concede that. And again, there are arguments on both sides, and I understand there's a legitimate policy debate, whatever my individual views are. If I were going to concede that because I thought it was not detrimental to the U.S. and potentially helpful, I would only have conceded that by receiving a large concession in response if I thought it was a good idea to concede it. So one of the problems we have with China is that we have to relearn again and again and again how that system works and how they conduct foreign policy and how they conduct deal making. They have the same regime with slightly different people. We have a complete reinvention of policy with every election, every few years. And the relearning process in the U.S. is very, very painful. And mistakes that are made by previous administrations don't always factor in to the conduct of current policy in the current administration. And that's true, by the way, even of the previous version of the same administration. They don't always absorb the lessons that were taught to them by the Chinese. The Chinese are formidable competitors. They're formidable negotiators. They're a serious country with a tremendous history, as we were saying, and a lot of advantages as well as vulnerabilities and weaknesses. We have to manage Chinese power. You know, America and China were never powerful simultaneously until the recent epoch. When China went into the tank, China went into a very long tunnel. The Qing dynasty overextended, eventually went bankrupt. There was a very long period where foreigners interfered in China, the Opium Wars and everything, the so-called century of humiliation. Again, the half century of Communist Party self-humiliation was worse. But nonetheless, there was this long period after 1800 till about 1979 that China went into a dark tunnel. That was precisely the period of the rise to superpower status of the United States. So the United States rose just when China went into the tunnel, the dark tunnel. And then the United States was there when China came out of the dark tunnel. So when China was the most powerful and richest country in the world before 1800, the United States didn't exist. It just came into being a few years before that. And so China enjoyed this kind of historical power without something like the U.S. being in the way. Now the U.S. is in the way when China comes out of this dark tunnel. And so what are they going to do? What's going to be the relationship? One of the things I like to say is that the United States and China have to share the planet. There's no way around sharing the planet. China is not going to disappear. The United States is not going to disappear. They're both powerful now, and that looks like the state of play in the foreseeable future. The issue is not sharing the planet. The issue is what are the terms of sharing the planet. Who's going to dictate the terms, and what are those terms going to be? Are the terms going to be what's happening in Xinjiang, or Tibet, or what happened in Hong Kong? Are those the terms? Or can the United States build leverage and use leverage to negotiate better terms of sharing the planet with China? Will the rest of East Asia look like Xinjiang? Or will the rest of East Asia look more like it does today? And that's the question for the U.S. to figure out. So without going to war with China, without capitulating to Chinese power, because that brings war eventually, appeasement doesn't avoid war. It just delays war and makes it more costly in the end. Without appeasement and without aggression, how do you manage to build that leverage and figure out how to negotiate better terms of sharing the planet with China? That is the number one task, the number one challenge for any administration, Democrat or Republican, you know, left or right. Today, going forward, we have not figured that out yet in the U.S. We are stumbling our way towards trying to figure it out with policy attempts and policy reversals and mistakes and concessions and announcements that aren't followed through. It will take some time for the U.S. to get its act together. People think that the Cold War with the Soviet Union started immediately. That, you know, George Kennan wrote a secret telegram and then published an article under pseudonym X, and Winston Churchill gave a speech in Missouri called the Iron Curtain Speech, and then the Cold War started right away. In fact, it took a really long time for the United States establishment and also for the United States public to understand that we were in a Cold War, not a hot war, of long-term competition with the Soviet Union to avoid a hot war. That's the beauty of Cold War. It avoids hot war because hot war is the worst outcome. It took a long time. It was really the invasion of South Korea by North Korea in 1950, in the summer of 1950, that finally galvanized the American public, more even than the coup in Czechoslovakia in 1948, the Berlin crisis in 1948, more than all the previous episodes. The Korean War invasion, North Korea's invasion of the South, galvanized the U.S. for the long term to compete with the Soviet Union to avoid the hot war. Remember, the U.S. and China fought a hot war in Korea when the Chinese came in. After the U.S. came in, the Chinese came in on the side of North Korea and the U.S. on the side of South Korea. And it was a bloody and terrible war, as wars always are. And we want to avoid that outcome. We want to learn how to share the planet, but we want to learn how to share the planet on terms that are more aligned with the values of the U.S., with the values of U.S. allies and partners and friends. And that process is slow, and it's herky-jerky. It's backwards and forwards and sideways and contradictory, and it's confusing, and there are a lot of mistakes being made. But that's just how policy develops, and I hope we can get to a better place over time, and the Chinese Communist Party, if it stays in power, can understand that the U.S. will not accept Chinese Communist domination of East Asia, let alone of regions beyond East Asia, and therefore must reach some type of accommodation with the existence of U.S. power.
Maybe we can talk about Taiwan. So what's stopping Xi Jinping from invading Taiwan? Well, what will stop Xi Jinping from invading Taiwan? What kind of calculations an autocrat in his position would do?
This is another really important question that you've asked. Again, difficult and important questions, all of them. Taiwan is an amazing success. Like South Korea, and before that, like Japan. Just extraordinary what the Taiwanese people have achieved. The level of prosperity, the freedom, the openness of their society. It's very inspiring to look at Taiwan. Moreover, Taiwan made an important contribution to the Chinese rise. to the revival of China following the horrors of Mao's rule. The Taiwanese people, Taiwanese technology, Taiwanese foreign direct investment, the Taiwanese engineers and managers have made a really important contribution to the benefit of mainland China. So if I were looking at it objectively, I would say this is a great asset. Look what they've done for us, and they can do more for us. But that, of course, is not how the Chinese Communist Party looks at it. They look at it as a threat. As a threat because it's an alternative. It's a successful, functioning, alternative system to the Chinese Communist rule that speaks Chinese. And so even more than Hong Kong, Hong Kong was a very significant threat in the perception of the Chinese Communist regime in Beijing. Even more than Hong Kong, Taiwan is a perceived threat. For the United States, its friends and allies, and for the Taiwanese, preservation of the status quo is really important. Taiwan is self-governing de facto, not in law, not in international law, but in fact, in reality, in what we call just ordinary, everyday existence, it is self-governing. That's a good outcome, and preserving that outcome is a good idea. And therefore, deterring mainland China, Xi Jinping's regime, from changing the status quo is really important. Not changing the status quo unilaterally on our side, and preventing a change, a unilateral change in the status quo by the communist regime. And how can we do that? Well, it's not simple because the Chinese communists are pushing the boundaries. They conduct these exercises, which are really rehearsals of a blockade around Taiwan at tremendous scale. And it's quite possible that one of those exercises becomes the actual blockade, because the difference between the exercises and an actual blockade is getting smaller and smaller. And so it's clear that they're practicing this type of aggression. They're trying to intimidate Taiwan, and they're trying to show people to back off, that we can do this, and if you try to interfere, it's just going to hurt you. So our job is to deter that type of action, is to show that if they try this, they will pay enormous costs and maybe fail. Moreover, that deterrence has to be military, yes, but also political. We need more of everything in terms of military assets in theater. We need more Tomahawk missiles in Japan and everything else that our admirals and generals are talking about. But we also need political deterrence. By that I mean we need Xi Jinping to think that if he does this and he fails, he could lose the communist regime. The communist regime in Beijing could fall. So we hear talk about how Xi Jinping wants to enter the history books as the Chinese leader who unified China by taking Taiwan, and our answer to that is he'll enter the history books as the Chinese leader who lost communist rule and destroyed Mao Zedong's regime and legacy. So there needs to be political deterrence, political narration, political narratives, as well as military deterrence. And there needs to be restraint on the part of Taiwan so that they don't provide a pretext for the Chinese communist regime to accuse the Taiwanese of changing the status quo unilaterally, in fact. And so it's a very delicate situation. Obviously, I don't tell you anything you don't know. And the ability to deter military and politically depends on Xi Jinping himself being deterrable, which we don't know. We could think we're deterring him, but he may not be deterrable in the ordinary ways that we understand the term. But I would say that every day Taiwan is self-governing is a good day. Every day we can extend the status quo is a good day. And so in the long term, I have no doubt that we will persevere in the competition with the Leninist regime in China, which has many more vulnerabilities and weaknesses than the U.S. and its allies do in political terms. But I want to make sure that in the short term, we don't get into a conflict, and so we have this long-term advantage at play already in the short term. So I don't have any answers, magical answers about Taiwan. Nobody does. I'm just trying to suggest that if you look at the political side, the political domain of deterrence more actively, more proactively, you can do a little bit better. Let's think about Deng Xiaoping. Deng Xiaoping is looking over the water at Japan. In 1969 already, Japan became the second largest economy in the world. Japan had been defeated in World War II. It was reduced to ashes, literally, when the Americans dropped two atomic bombs on the Japanese to try to compel the unconditional surrender. And Deng goes to visit Japan in 1979. And he can see for himself that this is working, that you have the second biggest economy in the world, and they were on the loser side of the war, whereas China was on the winning side, and it has this $200 per capita GDP under Mao's Cultural Revolution. So the winners are completely impoverished, and the losers are the second biggest economy in the world. So what was the secret? How did that work? How did Japan do this? And it was clear that they did it by an alliance with U.S. power. It was clear that they did this by building up manufacturing capacity domestically, but having full access to the American domestic economy. The Japanese produced a lot of things that the Americans wanted to buy. This access to the U.S. middle class demand, the insatiable appetites of the U.S. middle class, and the Japanese ability to produce at high quality and low cost goods that the American consumers wanted, that was the secret to Japan's rise from the ashes to the number two economy in the world. The same thing happened in Japan's two former colonies, South Korea and Taiwan. And so Deng Xiaoping, after his visit to Japan in 1979, at the end of the year goes to the United States and visits with President Carter. It's only then, not under President Nixon, but under President Carter, that relations are fully restored in the economic sense. And Deng Xiaoping attaches China to the American domestic market. And he receives most favored nation status, that is to say, access to the American domestic market to sell Chinese goods there, already in early 1980, and it's renewed every year until 2001 when it becomes permanent because China enters the WTO. And so China, under Deng Xiaoping, will copy the Japanese secret, the magic, the miracle of producing high-quality, low-cost goods and having total access to the American domestic market, just like Japan and just like Japan's two former colonies, Taiwan and South Korea. He's got a couple of secret levers, instruments. He has Hong Kong, the British financial institution. It's an international financial center built and overseen by the British. Had the Chinese got Hong Kong back in 1945 when the war ended, had the British not returned when the Japanese were defeated, but instead had Chiang Kai-shek taken Hong Kong, and then had, when Mao won the Civil War, taken Hong Kong from Chiang Kai-shek, there would be no Chinese miracle under Deng Xiaoping. Hong Kong was critical. British Hong Kong was critical for the success of Deng Xiaoping because it allocated capital by profit and loss, by economic criteria, not political patronage, not Leninist criteria. And that capital was Japanese and Taiwanese, and that technology was Japanese and Taiwanese and South Korean, and it was sent through Hong Kong into Shenzhen and the southern monsoon area of China, always the richest part of the country, that Pearl River Delta, which boomed like nobody ever imagined. And that was Chinese hard work and Chinese society and Chinese entrepreneurs and Chinese ingenuity. But it was also that Japanese model, because they sold that stuff into the American domestic market, that FDI and that tech transfer from Taiwan and South Korea and Japan routed through Hong Kong by economic criteria and then exported to America. The Chinese deserve the credit for being able to produce high quality, low cost goods. Not every country was able to do that. And the Chinese were able to follow Japan, South Korea, and Taiwan in doing this. But without the American domestic market, without copying that Japanese model that Deng Xiaoping had studied and visited, and without Hong Kong, the British colony, financial colony, and without the Taiwanese and their help in this regard, there would be no Chinese, mainland Chinese economic miracle. So in fact, mainland China, the regime in Beijing, they owe a lot to Taiwan. And that's the story we have to tell more of. And that's what I'm talking about, the political domain and the narratives. And deterrence is not only about missiles and drones and ships. It is about that, but it's also about political stories that are true and compelling.
I want to talk about Succession. The movie, The Death of Stalin, is super popular in China. And it dramatized a power vacuum with no clear successor. So in China, some people speculate that Xi Jinping will have to name a successor in 2027 at the end of his third term. Does he actually have to? For a dictator, what are the risks of doing so versus failing to do so?
This is one of the great vulnerabilities of all authoritarian regimes, is they don't have legal succession mechanisms. People talk about how there was a succession mechanism before Xi Jinping, and he violated it. In fact, it was just the way they practiced it. There was nothing which was compelling them to behave to limit to two terms. There was no compelling reason why they had to have the kind of succession practice that was introduced after Deng Xiaoping. It was just the way they decided to do it for a limited period of time. So they have never had and do not have a legal succession mechanism. In some cases, this is resolved by dynasty, by bloodline, as we see in the North Korean case, where they have fewer succession issues. They have succession issues, but just fewer or less radical succession issues, less extreme, because they have the dynasty. Even with dynastic succession, you have lots of vulnerabilities, because it could be the brothers, not just the son. It could be the son from the first wife versus the son from the second wife. It could be the uncle, etc. So you always have succession question marks, even when you have dynasty, let alone the absence of dynasty. One of the things that authoritarians do is they try to prevent successors from being identified because it weakens them while they're in power. If during their rule they begin to point to successors, people start to maybe accelerate the end of their rule to get to the successor. Or a competition to be the successor can begin to, let's say, gain momentum and destabilize the regime. So as with Stalin, to a certain extent with Mao, and as with Xi Jinping, they are very self-interested in not naming a successor so as not to reduce their own power, accelerate the end of their rule, or destabilize their regimes. This, of course, just makes it harder when they die. That very destabilization that they're trying to avoid while they're alive begins immediately as soon as they die. Plus, there are lots and lots of rumors about their ill health, their sickness, the fact that they're getting old and may have certain illnesses, their visits to the doctors. All of these things become a very widespread subject to rumors and speculation, which is also destabilizing to a certain extent of their regimes. So they have this succession mechanism where if they name a successor, it could accelerate the destabilization and undermine their power. And if they don't name a successor, it increases the likelihood of destabilization the second that they die or get sick, or that there are rumors of them getting sick. So it's a deep and fundamental problem for which there's no solution other than free and fair elections and the succession that works in the parts of the world that have legal succession. Even free and fair elections can be problematic sometimes in succession because the election results can be contested and so on. But it is by far the best, most stable, highest performing mechanism, free and fair elections. I don't think the Communist Party rule would survive free and fair elections. So instead, they are condemned to the uncertainty of the succession problem. I would be very skeptical that Xi Jinping would name a successor based upon historical precedent. Of course, he can do what he wants, and he could prove me wrong. And he could name a successor anytime. And he could also decide to step down and become the paramount leader behind the scenes, borrowing the Deng Xiaoping model that we saw so effectively enacted by Deng when he stepped down and named his successor. This is what I do know for sure. Xi Jinping has narrowed the first circle, the first echelon of power. The number of people who are in the first circle around him is narrower than it has been before. He has not just destroyed the Jiang Zemin faction, the Shanghai faction of Jiang Zemin, not just purged the military people who were beholden to Jiang and who were highly corrupt and stealing everything in sight. He then went on to do the same thing with Hu Jintao and with many others, with the Bo Xilai and others that you know. And so the regime has gotten narrower and narrower and narrower. And the number of people who have inside information, who know what's going on, who are given the kind of secret information that they need to do their work is smaller and smaller. The second echelon is farther from power now. The third echelon is much farther from power. It used to be that the members of the Central Committee were better informed. It used to be that the leaders of the think tanks were called in and could gain a certain amount of information. Some of those practices continue, but they know less than they knew before. And so this is also self-destabilizing in an unintentional way. People who don't know what's happening have a harder time being loyal. People who see purges, who see removal of loyalists who were appointed by Xi Jinping, they don't understand what that means for their own behavior, what they can do, what they cannot do, what are the limits, what they should be saying, with whom they should be associating. It creates a lot of uncertainty inside the regime to have a narrow inner circle with lack of access to the second and third echelon, and also to have this reduction of the other factions that provided a lot of the information to each other, but also to the leader by competing, denouncing each other to the leader and providing information to the leader. So Xi Jinping in some ways has made his regime less stable, less strong, by his narrowing of it. And again, his refusal to name a successor is built in. It's inherent to the dynamics of how authoritarian regimes work, because it reduces his power to have a successor alive. So I don't know what's going to happen following his regime. I don't know how long his regime will last. He's now in his 70s, but of course his mother, I believe, is almost 100. She must be 98 now. His doctors are very good. He's got the best possible doctors available in China. So he could live a long time still. I mean, anything can happen, but we have to be prepared that Xi Jinping could be in power for another 20 or 25 years, whether as the former leader or the behind-the-scenes paramount leader. And so we need to base our policies on the possibility that he will endure in power. And that's why I say our target is those people around him who are disaffected, disillusioned, resentful, patriotic, and worried about the trajectory of China, think that Xi Jinping staying in power too long is bad for China, bad for communist China. They're not anti-communist necessarily. I think those people, more than Xi Jinping himself, are the target. But again, China is this amazing civilization. The country is not reducible to the political regime. The society is really strong. It's full of amazing people. It's full of scientific and cultural geniuses. It's full of dynamic entrepreneurs and ingenious, inventive people. And those people should be our friends. China should not be our enemy as a culture, a civilization, a society. In fact, we should be aligned with their creativity, their productivity. We should be in partnership with them. We should be drawing them away from communist regime captivity and more towards defending China on its own terms rather than through the communist regime, at the same time as we learn to share the planet and negotiate better terms with the communist regime that might endure.
I'm sure some Chinese will be feeling very depressed hearing talking about another 20 years of Xi Jinping. I'm wondering, you know, people always ask me this question. I have no answer because I'm a journalist. What they are supposed to do under Xi Jinping, how they can, you know, there's only maybe everybody lives like 70, 80, 90 years, and they cannot imagine their life for another 20 years or even 10 years of Xi Jinping. And what are they supposed to do? How, this is about the sanity of many people and also the hope of many people. Just thinking about another 10, 20 years of living with no access to information and surveillance and oppression, it's very depressing. I don't know if you can shed some light, you know, how you think about this.
It's very difficult, of course, you're right. You know, I live in a free society. And it's easy for me to talk. It's easy for me to say how to live. I don't give advice to people living under unfree societies or living in exile. Their lives are very different from mine. I have luxuries. I cherish them, but I have luxuries that they don't have. And so I fully understand what they're going through because I study this and I write about it in my books and articles. And so this is what I would say. It's possible to live a free life even in an unfree regime. We have many examples of courageous people in China under the Chinese Communist Party's rule, but even way before that. who went about their lives not participating in falsehoods, not lying and stealing, not behaving in a way to ingratiate themselves with the regime, but also not necessarily opposing the regime because the costs are too high for yourself personally and for families. Not everybody can be a great dissident. Not everybody can win the Nobel Prize, the Nobel Peace Prize for opposing the communist regime and go to prison for their beliefs. It's hard to ask people, ordinary people, to undertake those kinds of sacrifices, especially when, like I say, I don't have to take any sacrifices like that to lead my life. But those people can still live with dignity. They can still live with pride. They can still live as Chinese descendants and participants in this amazing multi-millennia civilization. They can still raise families. They can still practice whatever scientific or cultural pursuits they want, even if not always to be rewarded for them, to be paid for them, to be officially employed that way. They have to make trade-offs. The trade-offs are difficult, beyond belief in some cases. They have to be careful to protect their children, their parents, their grandparents, their loved ones, their colleagues at work. It's psychologically oppressing. Of course it is. But it's possible nonetheless, through the solidarity of others like them, quietly in that society or abroad in the exile community, to live this life of dignity, of creativity, of being proud and being a participant in this enduring culture, this enduring civilization. I would say that sometimes the small things are bigger than we think. Sometimes the joy on the faces of a child or a parent or a colleague, or someone we've never met, just that we've found through Signal or through some other channels. Sometimes the joys, the small joys of those people can be really powerful, motivating, helpful to endure the oppression, the surveillance. I never recommend that people should take undue risks. I don't have to take those kinds of risks, and I can't recommend that others should do that. Some will, and I admire them, and sometimes it's awesome what they will endure, but that's not what I'm recommending. I'm recommending leading a life of dignity and commitment, of values and passion, of creativity and ingenuity, and of solidarity at whatever level one can achieve without exposing oneself to danger. China will endure. As the amazing civilization that it is, China will always be one of the great accomplishment civilizations in recorded history. The Chinese people will continue to do amazing things long after Xi Jinping dies, and he will die one day, just like Mao died and just like Stalin died. It will be too late for many people. It will be a long time to wait for many people. It will be heavy for those people who know China can be better and would love to dedicate themselves to China being better. But no, we should not lose hope. China gives us great hope. China is so impressive. It's so awesome. The people are so impressive and awesome. Keep alive the true history. Keep alive the true facts of China as a whole and of your individual families. Keep alive the truth, again, not taking undue risks. Keep alive whatever solidarity you can, whatever relationships you can. Feel, enjoy, propagate China as the amazing phenomenon that it is. And do that the best way you can under the constraints that you live under. And that's not enough, but it's a lot. And I support all those people who have to live in ways where their freedom is constricted. They can't be and do what they want, and I can be and do what I want, and I understand the luxury and the privilege. But those people can be amazing in their own way, and many of them are already, as we speak on this podcast. And they know the real history, and they have these great families, and they have these amazing businesses, and they work in laboratories, or they work in publishing houses, or they read on the side quietly when no one else is watching. And they know the truth, and they live the truth, and that's the way to be.
That's a very great place to end. Thank you. We asked each guest to recommend three books or movies. Do you have any recommendations?
I don't know if I could limit them to three.
Okay. More is good. Our audience love recommendations.
So one of my favorite novels is Auto da Fe by Elias Canetti. It was originally written in German. I read the English translation. I have a copy of the German one now as well. It's about a sinologist and the awkwardness of his life, but also his social life. He's socially very awkward, but he's considered the world's greatest sinologist, and it's the inner story of his life and awkwardness and the sinology and the profession of studying China. Canetti is a great writer. He also wrote Crowds in Power, but this one, Auto da Fe, or self-immolation, is what Auto da Fe is, French for self-immolation. That's one of my favorite all-time books. Probably my favorite book on China and the communist regime. I have many, many favorites. I don't want to slight any of the other great people who wrote books, but the Franz Schurmann book, he was a Slovenian emigre who taught at Berkeley, and in 1968, he published the book on China. I have it sitting right here in front of me. Sorry for the interruption. Ideology and Organization in Communist China.
Oh.
It's almost 60 years old. And many, many good books have been written since, but it captures the Leninist regime and the nature of the Leninist regime. It borrows a lot from this other book by Phil Selznick, The Organizational Weapon, mm-hmm. which is probably the best book ever written by the Leninist regime. But anyway, Schurmann applies the Phil Selznick analysis to Communist China, 1968. Again, the book is very old, but it's aged really well, like a fine wine. Again, I have many, many favorite great books about China, and I could pull them off the shelf. I have many, many hundreds of them right in front of me, and we could go on for another 2 hours about those books, but the Canetti book on Sinology and this Franz Schurmann book on the Leninist regime are two of the three I would probably recommend. And then for the third book to recommend, I would have to think hard, long and hard about this. But I think that book remains to be written. And it will be the book about Xi Jinping, his biography, that someone watching this podcast will write one day, hopefully after the regime has fallen and all the archives have been accessible. But until we have Xi Jinping's biography, people should read Joseph Terigian's biography of his father. His mother was also really powerful and important, as you know. But the Joseph Terigian book about Xi Jinping's father is absolutely phenomenal. And it's something really hard to do in a closed regime that doesn't allow its secrets, its documents to be seen. But in part, he used documents here at the Hoover Institution, including the Li Rei diaries. You know, Li Rei was for a time Mao's private secretary. And we have those diaries here at the Hoover Institution, thanks to the courage and the strength of the family, a really impressive family. And that source and many other sources allowed Joseph Terigian to reveal the nature of the party as a social phenomenon, the inner life not just of individuals, but of party members and of the party as a whole. It's a biography of Xi Jinping's father, in which Xi Jinping is very prominent, less interesting than the father in many ways, but it's really a biography of the Communist Party and membership of the Communist Party and the emotions, the aspirations, the hopes, the disappointments, and the moral squalor of communism that they experienced in their lives. It's a great book. I hope it will be translated into Chinese.
I hope so too. Yeah, I highly recommend that book as well. He came to the podcast and talked about it, and I wrote about the book for the New York Times. It's really a phenomenal book. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. And thanks for listening. And I'll see you next time.
My pleasure. Thank you. And best to all of your audience out there. I apologize I can't speak in Chinese. I wish I could. It's such a beautiful language, both the written and the spoken. But I'm very happy that you indulged me to speak in English.
Thank you.